I used to visit the cinema bookshop. It's now closed, which used to be run by someone called Fred Zettner. And I would always ask for books on avant-garde film, which he hardly ever stopped them. He never had them to stop. It was always Hollywood, you know. But the section gradually expanded to maybe 20 titles. And then one day he greeted me, saying that he had been reliably informed that the correct pronunciation of Jonas Mekas was Honas Mekas.
That would be in Hungarian, yeah. But in Lithuanian it is Jonas Mekas. It's very narrow.
Yeah.
Narrow E or A.
All right.
Try.
Jonas Mekas.
Still.
No?
Mekas. The second
one. Jonas Mekas.
Short and narrow.
Short and narrow. It's almost like a two A's. Mekas.
Or closer.
Mekas.
You say it slow then and speed it up.
Jonas.
That's correct.
Mekas.
Now say it faster.
Jonas Mekas.
Very close.
Okay.
Very close.
Okay, good. Well, we've got that out of the way. So.
But you see, I became Jonas because in English, in New York, the letter J, they will never pronounce it. Always J. J.
Yeah,
Joe.
Yeah.
Jonas. And math, that sound does not exist, as you can see.
Yeah. How difficult it's quite difficult.
It is. Yeah. So it became or Mekas or Mekas.
Yes.
And I used to, for some time I tried to correct, and then I gave up. It's
yeah.
waste of
yeah,
time.
Yeah, yeah.
It does not matter, really.
No. So, film culture. America's independent motion picture magazine started in January 1955.
Yes.
Dipping into early issues, I noted a review by Jeffrey Hendrix, which savaged On the Bowery, a film by Lionel Rogerson.
Yes.
A film which I saw for the first time only 3 years ago, yes. But which I thought was absolutely marvellous. I mean, it's
yes.
a wonderful film.
I disagreed with him.
Yeah.
But since I had engaged him as an editor, he insisted that if I do not print it, he would resign, and I needed him.
Right.
And I thought, okay, it's a little bit controversial, but I always liked the film, and it actually, as the time goes, it's more and more important as a document of the period of the real area of New York that now does not exist anymore.
Exactly, that's right. And there's a strange mix as well of documentary
It's like in the diaristic form, like I would compare me and Boris Lehmann,
who
is also keeps a diary, but sort of invents himself, makes up like real stories, like it makes there is artificiality which is not real artificial, same as in On the Bowery, but it is it's real and not real.
Right. But this phase of film culture initially, you weren't particularly sympathetic to the avant-garde originally.
I was for it, but I did not really understand it. It was just the beginning of my sort of contact with the avant-garde. I did not really understand yet what was really happening in the independent avant-garde of cinema in America. But what was happening that very moment, I was still in a sort of a heavy old European, almost pre-war, because the war, I had no contact with almost any culture or civilization.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I'm here, and something very fresh, something is happening, and I don't really understand. So some of it, it took me, I think, 2 or 3 years to really begin to really understand what it was. And then I had my St. Augustine conversion. Mm-hmm. I understood that I did not really, that I misunderstood completely what was happening in America in the arts. Mm-hmm. What helped was really meeting the artists and poets, and then, you know, I began understanding by real contact conversations and what was that it was completely something else that was happening.
Throughout this period, you were shooting and editing your own
yes.
diary footage.
I was not really editing, I was just filming. Mm-hmm. And I did not begin editing until like 10 years later. Oh. I began filming immediately when I arrived in New York in late 49. I edited all that footage between 1949 and like 61, only in like 1970 or somewhere there. Uh-huh. In between, in 61, 62, I decided to make my first feature.
Oh,
so
yes.
I sort of put everything on the side.
Yeah.
But at that time, I was already well become. It's during the filming of my first feature, Guns of the Trees, that I began. It was my first like movie into narrative cinema, but at the same time, it was the end of my interest in participating in making my first narrative cinema.
Yeah, yeah.
Though and my interest in, you know, as a writer, as a critic, or, you know, I was always, I am also writing for the Village Voice. I was the only one, the voice who could, I was covering the avant-garde and also the narrative cinema, Nouvelle Vague, etc. But I began moving into already other forms of cinema.
I've also brought this along. This is the first...
one of the first, yes.
That's number
catalog
one.
Catalog of Filmmakers Cooperative, yes.
This
that
is 19...
was created in January 62. First we had some Xerox copies of the first catalog. This is like the second or so. Filmmakers Cooperative was like an alternative film distribution organization center, because the independents, the avant-garde, did not have an organization distribution center of their own, dependent on two or three distributors with a very, I would call, a narrow taste that they accepted. Some, let's say bracket, accepted some of his films, but refused others. And as the time goes, one sees that they refused some of his best early work. And at that point, we decided to create our own distribution center where we control all and the films that go into the distribution. It's the filmmaker decides, not the distributor.
Mm. The diary footage, Stan Brakhage said that not enough has been said about the influence of Marie Mankin mm-hmm. on Jonas Mekas' style of footage. Is this correct? Do you remember?
I would say that it's correct. Mm-hmm. Marie Mankin is, by the way, also of Lithuanian origin.
Really?
Yes. So we became very good friends immediately. She was second generation. She was born already in United States, but she grew up, but she still spoke Lithuanian, and she would write and sing. We used to sing Lithuanian songs together. She has very lyrical sensibility. I saw her films only. Those that I really admired and I think influenced me, the one that I think influenced me was called Notebook. made maybe in 60 or 61, which really, like, see, the question of influence is complex. It's more like you see something that you want to do or you were doing yourself, but now you see it, somebody else is doing very similar thing. So you get this solidarity, this mm-hmm. encouragement. Ah, so okay.
Yeah.
You see, so it's okay, she's doing that, and it works. So I was very really impressed with that film, and therefore it helped me to continue and develop my own way of filming, which coincided very much with what she was doing at that moment. And of course I developed went different directions, but at that point it was very important to me. And it was very important also to Brakhage. You know, he was the same way. He was influenced the way I was influenced by Marie Mangan. I think that the first time when I and my brother we began thinking about making a film was after seeing a post-war film by Fred Zinnemann called The Search. It's about a family, it was about displaced persons, refugees in Eastern Europe. We thought that it was, he did not have any idea, did not understand what it means to be a refugee and what it, and why the whole thing is happening, that we have to make a film and show really to what is happening and how it's happening mm-hmm. and why, all the reasons, how you feel in exile or being a refugee. So that's what started us, and that our first notes for the script was just an actual, I later made a film called Lost. But the first idea for it came, that was already in 48, already in this displaced person camps and camp in Kassel, that we wrote with my brother. The first notes for a film called Lost, four times, right. Later mm-hmm. they reduced it to three.
The Filmmakers Distribution Center, apparently it was forced to close.
First there was Filmmakers Cooperative.
Yeah.
When Filmmakers Cooperative was created in January 62, all the avant-garde filmmakers became part of it, but some of the filmmakers who were already beginning their first features, narrative features, some of them had already made one or two and had dreams for making more, I thought that being together with the avant-garde, with those who make short experimental films, personal films, would throw some veil up on their films that they would not be attractive to commercial distributors, theaters across the country, would minimize their visibility. So they did not join. Shirley Clark, Lionel Rogozin, Molly Sanger, Billy Antonio, there are a good number of them. They thought they will, because they had bigger dreams. Then 3-4 years passed, those dreams did not realize. It was what's called a pipe dream. Because what they were making at the time, the subject matter and style and technique was still too new, too different from what was accepted as will be publicly acceptable. And they did not get financing, they did not get distribution. So around 66, they decided that maybe they made a mistake, that maybe they should have joined. And I think myself that they made a mistake. They would have joined at the beginning. Cooperative would have grown, expanded differently, and they would have received their own success, so to speak. So they created a separate branch. They still did not want to be really part, called Filmmakers Distribution Center. But when you be, then they thought, we'll be now part of this filmmakers distribution center. We will advertise it. We will make it visible, and people will come and rent our films, show our films. But what they discovered is that they had nobody was willing to put money into promotion or advertising. So it was sitting there, and again, in like, okay, for like there were in 2 years, for 2 years, it was sort of active, but then had to be closed.
Yeah.
Went into debts, and I had to really bail them out with my own money.
Well, the report was that you it apparently left you with $80,000 of yes. personal debt.
Yes, because they borrowed money, you see, to do some advertising and to pay, you know, the making prints, etc. And then monies were not coming in, and those who had lent money wanted to take not only them to court, but also filmmakers cooperative, because they were part of the cooperative.
Yeah.
So at that point, because I had just made something for television and received mm-hmm. some money, so all that money went to pay.
I've never heard that before. Yes. What did you make for television? What was that?
There was a public television program. They invited me, Richie Leacock, the poet Leroy Jones, Penny Maker, yes, I think four of us, to make like 20 minute, it was a quartet of four films.
Yeah.
So that was my, in fact, my only television production ever.
Right. And what was
the guy who was running, this guy Oppenheim, he liked what I was doing and he wanted to help, so he pulled me in as part of the film.
And what was the subject of your section?
It was my part, the main part of it was, there were other things, but main part was Peter Beard's wedding.
So do you shoot diary Facing. Footage now? Do you
still it's on the video.
You shoot video?
Yes.
On video. DV, mini DV?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Sort of every day, like it's still like a diary every day?
Yes, I videotape every day. But
Do you have any regrets about film? I mean, you're pretty,
no,
are you as happy
with
it?
No, I have no regrets because I know that things move ahead. Technology has changed. First there was only 35, then 16, 8 came in. I mean, then it all was good for 110. For 20 years. I think that the new technologies come at a time when our thinking, our ways, styles of life, living change, and so we bring in new technologies that go with everything else that is changing, and we adopt and use it already to record what's happening in a different, more contemporary way. And that includes all the memories and lessons from the past, from all the other media of making moving images. The past is incorporated into the present, and it's where we move ahead.
At one time, you referred to what was called artist's film with slight disdain. You had a kind of, there was a separation, wasn't there, between the filmmaker's film and artist's film?
Really, it was not, maybe I used that term somewhere, but it's, first there is a big problem about, you know, art.
Yes.
But some films, in a way one could group some films put in grade that category that are not that like inspiration to them comes not like from cinema. Some of okay, take an example of Paul Sharritt. Mm-hmm. He always wanted to be a painter,
right.
And did everything to. And he was, I think, not such a bad painter. But some of the films that he did and were influenced by some ideas that came from the artists who paint like, Maurice, Calandre, from certain section of contemporary modern art. And it influenced some of the, Stan van der Beek also wanted always to be a painter, and some of his early work are influenced, like, so they fit into galleries, and some Paul Charette's actually early films were shown in the galleries, and they looked, they fit there better somehow than in the motion picture theaters. And he preferred that. So there was, the earlier Oscar Fischinger. One could sort of make something with it, with that kind of theory.
But your own film, Walden, is now in Tate Modern. It has its own little, doesn't it?
Where now we are talking about something else. It's about the changing ways of distribution, about the disappearing of the public theaters, and the growth of the home of screens with and video distribution and systems, so that there are few like filmmakers cooperative. There were some, and there were theaters, universities, colleges renting films and screening. They're not screening anymore. They are in DVDs and they're closing their film libraries. Galleries became like another place for another outlet, another possibility to show films as films, or even as on DVD. So my own films, like now, right now, this very moment, my last long film, as I was moving ahead, occasionally I saw brief glimpses of beauty. It's shown at PS1 in a room of itself for 1 month or 2 months. It's running there in a gallery situation.
Yeah.
And it's okay.
Yeah.
And that's about the only way one can show today. As film, there are very few places in some museums, like anthology film archives, or Museum of Modern Art, or Beaubourg, or there are very few places where these films, you will be able to see these films as films.
It's a difference, isn't it, between what you might call theatrical presentation and a kind of gallery presentation. In a gallery, the film can just run over and people can sort of come and go as they please. There's no beginning or end to the screening, as it were.
Yeah, but maybe it's one went to the theater for like a different kind of experience, and now we are able to see them more for what they really are, and out of that context of popcorn or just as films, when they are in video.
I wanted to ask you about this thing of out of context, because it seems to me that your approach to filmmaking and your interest in memory and perhaps the loss and maintenance of it.
No, I'm not interested in memory and maintenance of memory.
Really?
No, I'm not.
Why do you film 365 films a year?
Like I was mentioning abstractly that it's automatically past is incorporated in present because we inherit. We come, with everything that cinema arts have already past is in us, and whatever we do, already we do automatically with all that backlog, of history in us. But so I don't have to be interested. I really have no interest in.
You've worked as an archivist and so on.
Oh, because I want to share with my friends. That's why I created the cooperative. That's why I ran the Cinematheque and Anthology Film Archives, because I want to share when I see a film and I like it. And there is nobody, talk to my friend. Just where can I see it? So that, you know, of course, I had to start screenings, and I want to share with others,
okay,
and see that they don't disappear, they don't fall to dust. I want it from the sense of need of to share.
I wonder if, do you feel that now that you know, you've had the rise of things like YouTube and Flickr and the sort of internet culture,
yeah,
where everyone films with, say, their phone or digital cameras,
yeah,
little moments from their lives, little non sequiturs, and then stores them on a large database remotely, like YouTube or Flickr. Mm-hmm. I wonder if really what's going on there is a sort of a deferral process, which is about not actually coming to terms with things and not taking an editorial decision. Do you think there's any truth in that?
I think people who put their work on YouTube, they also want to share. They are excited about something, or either find it funny, or there are various other reasons. They want to put it there because that's one access that is, it's so easy to, you know, and to share and put it there, and everybody can see it.
But possibly there is so much that you cannot engage with it. So, for instance, people, you know, when I took still photographs with a 35mm camera, I'd have 36 exposures, and I'd have to really think about what I do because I couldn't afford to just go and shoot. Now this camera I have with me in my pocket, probably I can take up to 300 images and up to maybe...
Yeah, but one is also realistic, one knows that, you know, you cannot put, I mean, you have other things to do and you cannot put everything on, so, or you cannot see everything that is there. And then time, as time goes, you know, things disappear and other people. And that memory will fade out because in 10 years, will be, most of it will be gone. Mm. Except those pieces that people really found something there that they wanted to keep, and they transfer into their own systems, they download and share with friends. And some of it disappears as time goes also. So only those that have very intense moments of something that will remain. So I believe in a sense in Darwin's principle in art, as in any other area of life. Because if people are not interested, you can see once, twice, and they have a good laugh, or and that's it. And you don't, you forget, and that will disappear. So it's okay. I don't mind that there are millions of those pieces floating, because what will remain, only what will be important to humanity, to humans, for one or other reason to keep.
Resonance FM presents Otomo Yoshihide, live in London on Monday the 24th of November, with special guests including Steve Beresford, Eddie Prevost and DJ Sniff. At Café Otto, 18 to 22 Ashwin Street, Dalston, London E8. Details, cafeotto.co.uk. Otomo at Otto, Monday the 24th of November. Hello, I'm Alex Kolkoski. Welcome to Small Pool Room, Two Cuts on Resonance FM 104.4, a series dedicated to vintage sound recordings. You've just been listening to a woodplaner recorded in the early 1950s as a sound effect on the major records label New York. I'm following on from last week's show when I closed with a sound effects record from the 1930s called Felling Tree, Sawing with Crash of Tree Falling. And this week's programme is devoted entirely to the sounds of the saw on 78 RPM records, most of them played on a wind-up gramophone from the 1927, to be precise, live here in the studio. The first record on the gramophone is from the late 1920s, from Berlin, on the Berlin Odeon label. This particular record was made for export to Russia, the writing is in Cyrillic as well as in German, and it's the Song of the Volga Boatman, played by Dr. Otto Frederich on the musical saw, or Singende Säge, singing saw as it's known in German, accompanied by an instrumental trio.